the horrors of war are indescribable, leaving many people scarred physically and emotionally for life. But the terror and fear of the battlefield often lead to another type of fear, the fear of not being accepted when you return home. This is Focus on the Family, and today we're going to hear from a Vietnam veteran who had a very good reason to fear that homeward journey. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Steve Kelly, sitting in for Mike Trout, who's continuing his ambitious bicycle ride from the Pacific Ocean all the way to the Atlantic. Now, let's listen to a recording that Dr. Dobson made with Mike Trout, and then we'll hear from that special guest.
Well, Mike, this program is going to move like a freight train, and the reason is because our guest, by way of videotape and then the soundtrack from that videotape, is a man named Dave Reaver. He is well known all across the country, especially on high school campuses. Dave Reaver was wounded in Vietnam. Part of his face was blown off. He lost a partial use of his thumb. He had many, many injuries. He's fortunate to even be alive. And now he speaks to high school students across the country, and they love him. And I think you'll see that in about the first 30 seconds of the tape that we're about to hear. The audio track that we're going to air, and you were only going to hear a portion of it, was taken from a VHS video entitled Davy, the High School Experience. And I need to issue a kind of an explanation, not a disclaimer, but an explanation up front. Dave's method of speaking involves overstatement, and it might in some instances be offensive to some adults, but it is that overstatement that the kids love, and he uses that approach to get them to listen to him. He's fascinating to listen to because he's running in high gear, as I said, and I just ask the adults who are listening to us to overlook perhaps a style that may not fit your taste in this instance, because he's not really talking to you. He was talking to kids. This videotape was made in a high school auditorium, in an assembly, where he was doing some flag waving and offering some advice and, of course, telling his story.
And I want to leave as much time as possible, so let's get on with it, shall we?
All right. You know, it's a little hard to believe, but most of our listeners, based on the information we have of who does tune in this broadcast, probably don't remember the Vietnam conflict as well as Dave Reaver does, or as you and I do, or the other listeners in our audience who actually lived through it and perhaps participated in it. So this will be an eye-opener to them in more ways than just one.
Yeah, Mike, I do want to add one other comment on behalf of our Canadian listeners. I've become very sensitized to the offensiveness to Canadians and the British and others when we do a little flag-waving here. I've already said that that is part of Dave Reaver's approach. And I apologize at the top here to our Canadian listeners when he says, it's great to be an American. Well, we know that we crossed the line there a little bit on behalf of people in other countries. But patriotism doesn't hurt anybody. I hope somebody in Canada is waving flags like that too today. So maybe you'll also understand that aspect of what we're about to hear.
Yeah, that's an important clarification. Here's Dave Reaver.
Thank you, and good morning. I like that. It's great to be back. Do you know I've waited a year to get this opportunity? Because I believe in you, young people. You're what makes up America. This is, to me, people who put down our country. I want to drag them by the ear into an assembly like this. And I speak to 250,000 of you kids a year. I wish I could drag them in here so they don't say, now tell me there's no hope for tomorrow. Tell me our country's down the drain. I'm looking at the finest, the brightest, the coolest dudes. And I thought I'd throw that in for your sake. That America's ever been able to bring through their school systems. But I also know you're going through problems and you have big questions and difficulties. And sometimes they get out of balance. Sometimes they get so far out of balance, you do stupid things that you live the rest of your life wishing you had never done. And we want to help you eliminate some of those things. I was no different than you. I sat in school. Trigger and Roy Rogers and Dale Evans came to my school. Isn't that cool? You don't even know who they are. I'm 38 years old, and I'm not over the hill. I am the hill, but I'm not over the hill. I married my high school sweetheart. Hey, hey, hey. And we went off to college after we graduated from school, and I had a very good job, a good house, a good wife, a good school, and bad grades. I worked so much and studied so little, my check went up, my grades went down, and I dropped to a C minus from a good solid C, you know. I mean, what more can a guy ask for than a good solid C? And the problem was, though, that I got a letter from Uncle Sam, and it said, greetings, nephew.
See, uncle and nephew.
It's going to be a long hour, isn't it? I knew what it meant. Well, they told me to go take my physical, and I wrote back and said, I feel great. You go take physical, you know. So that didn't work either. I took my physical, studied all night, passed it, and they told me I was to be inducted into the Army. Now, this was the new twist for me, because I was your basic chicken. See, I didn't want to get hurt, and so I didn't want to go to war, because I figured that can be dangerous to your health. So I went down and joined the Navy. Well, I could have gone to Canada, but I was too proud to go to Canada, too chicken to go to Vietnam, and being a proud chicken, I joined the Navy. I figured I was safer 4 years on a ship than 4 seconds in the jungle. So I joined the Navy, because I didn't think they'd float a battleship in a rice paddy.
My second day in boot camp, they told me I was going to Vietnam. Now, I'm going to tell you, that was a shocker for this man.
I did not know what to do. There were no alternatives at that point. And to get us prepared, I was trained with in what's called riverine warfare. I was with a group called River Division 573. And we trained in conjunction, I ran probably in conjunction with the SEAL team, which is the meanest, baddest bunch of dudes I've ever seen in my life. I mean, they're mean. They eat rocks. They eat their young. They eat anything that eat them. And honestly, I'm just telling you the facts, man.
We ran till I thought they were going to kill us before they could take us to Vietnam and shoot us. If you've never seen a fat boy run 8 miles, it's totally awesome. I mean, all right, 15 minutes after we were through running, I was still jiggling all over. And then I lost so much weight, I had to tease the hair on my legs to keep my socks up. But, man, then they said, now today we're going to teach you how to escape from prison. Two things entered my mind. One, I don't ever plan on going to prison. Two, I'm so skinny I walk through the bars and go home. And then they said, and we're going to teach you how to live without eating food. The next thought entered my mind was, I learned that in the high school cafeteria. And he said, we're going to teach you how to use your hands and feet like weapons. That was funny because, you know, I felt like Joe Cool. But I didn't realize the day would come that I would realize there was no Joe Fool going to stand there while I kick him in the face as they said we could, you know. And there were a lot of things they did teach us. There were some things they just didn't get around to teaching us. Things like how to die gracefully or how to die at all. They never taught us how to say goodbye to people you love. I wasn't the only married man in the group. But when I'd ask the question, nobody seemed to know what the answer say. You know, what's it going to be like when you say goodbye to your wife? I think some of them said, it's going to be heaven on earth, you know. No, it's not the way it works for us, though. Brendan and I, we're very much in love. Newlywed, but that didn't cheapen our love, man. I stood at the airport, and I looked that teenage girl in the face. I want to tell you, when I kissed her goodbye, it's the hardest thing I ever did. And people said to me, how could you do it? I said, well, I puckered my lips, and I put my arm. I know it's facetious, but it's fun to be facetious, right? They're saying, you, of all people, I mean, you're a minister's kid. Your dad was a minister. You were a Bible college student, even. How could you fight in such an unpopular war? I mean, no good American would fight in an unpopular war. I didn't know Americans fought in popular wars. When's the last time you had a good popular war? You could enjoy going and killing and being shot at. Oh, you got me, but move over. Really make it hurt. Here's the, this is a popular war. It's okay. It's like popular cancer. You'll love this when it eats your head off. Enjoy it, man.
You know, it
doesn't make sense to me. I don't know this popular war game. I hate war. And for every veteran that's here that's one of your teachers, they'll tell you, war's the pits, man. I hate it.
It's hell. So I went to war. And really, you know,
no matter how much you train, you're never fully trained. I got on the bus, they had big screens on the windows. I said, are the flies that bad? And they said, no, idiot,
that's to keep the hand grenades out, not the flies.
It never dawned on me. Suddenly, now somebody's trying to kill me. That's a bad feeling.
You wake up this morning and say, what?
Someone's trying to kill me today. It messes up your whole day,
you know?
They sent me into the jungle, and I found out right away my biggest problem wasn't some communist shooting at me out of the bushes. My biggest problem was in my barracks. Now, admittedly,
thank God they didn't shoot at me.
But they never tried to hurt me physically. But I will tell you this.
They tried to tear down some things that meant more to me than limb
and life.
And I say
this from my heart to you, young people. Because I did not participate, it must be diplomatic, you know, in their, quote, extracurricular activity, unquote.
Because I didn't go along with
what they were doing, I was ostracized, belittled,
ridiculed,
humiliated, libeled, tricked,
everything else they could do to get me to break the vows to the woman I had made vows to.
Now, you may not be in
with this kind of
loyalty, but
I want to tell you something, man. When I told that girl the day I married her that I'd be faithful to her and I'd do, or whatever I said, the way I said it, I meant it.
And there wasn't any jerking for you.
Now I'm worth breaking those vows over.
I loved her.
Now, loyalty means something to me. Little did I know then what the day was coming off that
would give me a return on that loyalty.
That would make that loyalty worth every moment
of the difficulty it cost me.
Now, they'd say things like, oh, come on, Reaver. Everybody's doing it. I said, well, if everybody's doing it, why are you trying to get me to?
Obviously, I'm not.
And until I do it,
not everybody is. So back off,
turkey lips.
Now, you mark this, kids. I'm going
to tell you. There was a lot of things you believe in and you stand for that someone's always going to come along and try to cheapen for you. But if you're believing it with your whole heart,
you stand by your guns.
Don't give up on what you believe, because that's you. And you have the right to stand for what you believe. Well, anyway,
these guys are always on my case.
They nickname me.
These guys, they call me Dudley Do-Right,
Walter Doolittle,
and Preacher Man.
That's the thing. I'll call them Pervert Number One, Pervert Number Two,
and Pervert Number Three. That's how they got along, Preacher Man and the Pervert.
Sounds like a rock gospel band, doesn't it?
They never backed
off. Always on my case.
You know how I stayed
out of trouble? I stayed busy.
And that's why some of you knuckleheads get in trouble.
You get bored. You got
nothing to do.
And so you say, hey man, let's go do this.
Okay, that's...
No, man, that's stupid. No, it's cool. You do it, and everybody says, well, that's cool. Then you get caught,
and they say,
that's stupid. You're black. We still wanted it. You get bored. You think this is cool. Let me tell you something. If you keep yourself invested in your good, healthy mind and your good, healthy body, you're invested
in doing something productive,
you just might find the results can be very beneficial.
Instead of wasting your life and your time, invest it.
Invest it.
I did. I was
very inventive. And my inventive mind and my willingness to
stay busy
got me promoted in rank.
And the guys who called me Billy D. Wright
had to call me sir. That's right.
That's bad. Right? I don't mean
that. Well, they actually call me sir Dudley D. Wright. On the 25th of July, the worst firefight we ever encountered occurred. 13 B-40 anti-tank rockets were fired at my little four-glass bullet with four men on it.
Now, that four-glass bullet was going to start off that rocket about like taping a shade with it. 13 times they fired at point blank range, and I don't exaggerate, probably overestimating that they were as close as that wall, though they may have been closer.
Now, they could have thrown the rockets and hit us, and 13 times we fired, we missed his 13th round. Totally lost.
I mean, it was almost to the point. There goes
no, you know. Done, Jerry. You can't even see the thing, you know. We were cold.
But we were scared. We didn't know what to
do. But we were getting as fast as we could get. Well, we cleared the kill zone. The next day, we were right back at the point of enemy contact. And we
reached the boat up on the bank of the river
at the very point that the biggest fire and weapons had come from. A gigantic open bunker. I saw movement in the bunker. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what to do. Except the old rule of war that says he who shoots
first lives longest.
I learned to run on gun smoke. Well, we didn't know if there was actually anybody in there or not. When you're not sure, though, you won't take chances. I grabbed the first thing I could get my hands on, a white phosphorus hand grenade. Now, obviously, a hand grenade against a bunker is like a BB gun against a boxcar. It's not going to do much. But at least it would put up enough smoke to give us a means to get away from the direct line of fire. It would burn down the high portion and make booby traps if there were any there. I'll pull the pin on this devastating grenade that burns so hot I've been told nothing in my vehicle. I'll pull the pin back, drew the grenade to throw it, and at that moment the grenade exploded. The litter I flat out of sniper's bullet went to the back of my hand. The only molecule in the back of my body was any damage was a bullet went through, hit the grenade. It blew 40% of my skin off of me, 60 pounds of my flesh off of me. I went blind in my eye, a biff in my ear, because the whole right side of my face landed in front of me and looked back at me. And I want to tell you something, folks. When you see yourself coming back, you go, well, you baby. I could.
Incredibly, I didn't have any
point in it all, but I was blind and deaf. Now, the good news is,
I have my vision better, and I have my hearing better. I see perfectly.
I wear glasses
because I look cool with my glasses.
I put my name on them right there. You do that.
Well, excuse me.
Get it? Oh, my.
Veering back to you.
When I saw the fish wall, and I have. Oh, this is. My hair was. My hair was so. This was first. It was slow.
Man,
every time. Think what you want. You can say, oh, what.
And I'd
rather be chilling with a Western woman, having fun, making friends, having a blast, laughing about it all, sitting on some Western woman dinner, pop, sucking suds of shit. Grudge, you can tell the walls together, you know, let garbage blow forward, but don't you. Well, I'll be on you, I'll go. You won't remember. Don't come down. Walker, I'll run you off the road. Why you up here? Because I don't believe in shooting people. Listen to me. Kiss girl, wait a second. I walked into one of your apartments. It was across the street.
Again, disciplining your children at the moment of birth. And so we just need to define our terms there.
It is important to distinguish between those two words because they are fundamentally different. You have a guiding philosophy about that, don't you? That the whole idea of punishment should be differentiated from what you consider to be proper discipline.
Yes, discipline is done on behalf of the child. It's done with love. It's done for the child. Punishment, in some senses of the word, I don't always use it this way, but for some people at least, punishment has a connotation of hostility, of an aggressive act, of something one person does to another one instead of for the other one. And discipline, in the more loving sense, does in fact begin at the moment of birth. I remember a conversation we held and later aired here on Focus on the Family with Dr. Bill Sloniker, a pediatrician, my very good friend in Nashville, Tennessee. And he said that if discipline begins on the second day of life, you're one day late. You begin right there to teach the child. And immediately you have an image of a parent spanking a child or closing him in his room, and that's not what Dr. Sloniker meant, obviously. He was referring to the parent being in charge, loving that child incredibly, but being in control. He says that it is very frustrating to him as a physician to see how the parents of young children have so little control and are frightened of their kids. For example, a mother will call and say, my six-month-old baby is crying, and he seems very hot. And Dr. Sloniker will say, does he have a fever? And the mother will say, I don't know. He won't let me take his temperature. Now, that's what he means by discipline beginning at birth. That mother is not in charge. Already, that six-month-old is controlling the situation. Food is another example of very early discipline. Children do not like vegetables in the first couple of years of life, but they need vegetables. And parents are afraid to allow a child to get hungry. But it will not hurt a youngster to get hungry in order to eat the things that he does not want to eat. You know, it's a form of very early discipline. Now, all of the conversations you and I are going to hold on this subject open the door to extremes and people misunderstanding what we're saying. And even right here, I can see someone misunderstanding and thinking I'm talking about starving a child and so on. I'm not. I'm talking about a parent who loves that little child and wants the best for him, but realizes in order to do that he or she must be in control, and that starts at birth. Mm.
So I, as a parent, should try to get across to my young child that there's somebody in the house who's in charge. There's a leader.
That's half the message. The other half is that somebody loves you, little child, more than you can possibly understand. And it is the security of that love with the security of those limits that produces healthy kids. You get both of those ingredients together in the parent-child relationship, and you've got it together.
Can you remember the first time you ever expressed that message to your own children?
Yes, our daughter Danae was 9 months of age when she directly challenged the authority of her mother, and most strong-willed kids will do this in the first year of life. It always comes as a shock and a surprise to parents that this little youngster who was born at 7 pounds a few months ago, could not move, could not turn over, could not hold his own bottle, couldn't speak, couldn't walk, 8 or 9 months later looks into the face of a 150-pound man or a 100-pound woman and says, where do you get off telling me what to do? You know, it's just an incredible thing. But when Danae was 9 months of age, she did that to her mother. Shirley was sweeping in the kitchen, and she had swept up a little pile of dirt and dust, and Danae crawled up to the edge of the kitchen, and Shirley saw that she was going to crawl in and into that dust, and she said, no, Danae, don't come in. Now, at 9 months of age, Danae understood that word no. She couldn't say it herself, but she understood it, and she came in anyway. Now, Shirley picked her up and took her back and said, "No, Danae." Now, here you got a situation where mother is giving an instruction and a child is saying, "But I don't want to follow it." It was a pretty clear confrontation. The first time that Danae had said, "What if I don't do what you tell me to do?" She crawled in again. Shirley took her back again and set her down and said, "No." And Danae crawled across that threshold 7 times before she finally gave up. Now, here was a situation where Shirley won the confrontation. She did it without any physical pain. There wasn't any punishment or anything of that nature. But each time she took Danae back, she set her down a little more forcefully and said, "No." And you can see in the teaching situation there, a child beginning to learn that I have to do what mother says to do. And if Shirley had despaired of the situation, which she could have done much quicker, it took time to carry that child back 7 times, took energy, then she would have lost an opportunity to teach that she was in charge and that Danae had to obey. So that's just a typical early situation. Every parent of a strong-willed child, and most of the compliant ones too, knows what I'm talking about. Those moments occur. When Danae was 15 months of age, she got her first little spanking. It's very clear in our family memory, and we talk of it often. Shirley was building a fire. It was kind of raining outside, and she wanted to put some wood in the fireplace. And so she went out behind the garage to get the wood, and it was already sprinkling by that time. Danae was barefoot, and Shirley didn't want her to run out and catch cold and get wet, so she told her not to come out. And Shirley went behind the garage to get the wood, and when she came back, Danae was running across the patio. And Shirley took her back, and she said, "Danae, I told you not to come out." And Danae came out 3 times. All right, here's another confrontation. See, here her mother is saying, "Don't you do that." And a 15-month-old who is fully capable of processing that command is saying, "I will." All right, you have a deliberate confrontation, a deliberately willful, defiant act. That's when the parent must respond. Those are the things you look for. And so Shirley got a little switch and spanked her legs a little bit. It was the first time Danae had ever been spanked, 15 months of age, and it didn't amount to a whole lot, but Danae cried. Shirley went on, and she was putting the wood in the fireplace and getting ready to light the fire. And Danae came up behind her and put her arms around her and said, "Love, Mommy." And, of course, Shirley turned around and just engulfed her in her arms and held her to her and explained that she had to mind her mommy. Now, that would horrify some people who don't understand discipline, at least have a different comprehension of it than I do. But in those early months, even before toddlerhood, there are those moments when the issue is who's in charge here. And it's important for the parent to win, but to win with love.
Well, let me role play with you for just a second and take the part of one of our listeners who might ask, "But Dr. Dobson, I don't think I can really tell the difference between when my child is challenging my authority and when he's just doing what children do. I don't think I can see the difference between those two."
Well, when you see clearly that the child understands the issues, and you have made it abundantly clear to him, and a parent can do that. The key to good parenting is to be able to get behind the eyes of the child and see what he sees and feel what he feels and know where he's coming from. So when you do that and you know that he is pitting his wit and his will against yours in a kind of a mini contest, then it's time for you to respond with a little more firmness. And my model here and in all discipline is the Bible. Now, this may not seem like a theological understanding, but it is. I believe that I am in greatest danger before God when I know what He wants me to do, and I look in His face and I say, "I won't do it. I know what the Bible says. I know what you've communicated to my heart, God. I won't do it." Those are the times of haughty pride and arrogance that the Bible speaks of in very, very forceful terms. And his anger at the children of Israel was because they had been given such an understanding of who he was that other people hadn't been given, and they deliberately and willfully defied him. You see, it's in the understanding. That is a basic philosophy of discipline. There are 10 or 12 places in the Bible where understanding, comprehension of misdeeds is critical to the accountability factor. And it's when my child knows what I want and knows that it's right and refuses to do it willfully and defiantly, that's when we must respond, because respect is at stake in that moment.
I've heard you express that idea many times. You're really talking about knowing your child. You call that, I think, one of the primary objectives of parenthood, to study a child. No, we can't read our child's mind. We're not always right. Yes, sometimes we do discipline them in a moment of childishness and overlook discipline in a moment of rebellion, but that's one of our targets, isn't it? To watch that child and try to discern what's going on in their mind with respect to our authority as the parent.
I have said that many times, Mike, and I'll say it as long as we have this radio program, but I'm not sure that I've said this. It's even broader than that. A few years ago, Christian Herald magazine contacted me and asked if they could do an interview with me, which was later published in the magazine. And one of the questions that they asked me was intriguing. They said, is there a unifying formula? Is there a philosophical understanding? Is there one concept that will explain all human relationships and lead to healthier families? And I gave an impulsive answer to it. It was an interaction, and I said, no, I don't think so. I made reference to the fact that Albert Einstein spent his entire adult life looking for a unifying theory of physics that would explain the nature of the universe. And he was very disappointed because he never found it. The physical world is simply too complicated, and I doubt if we will ever find it, because the physical world is as broad as God's mind. He made it. And the more you learn, the more you find out there is to learn. So he never found it. And likewise, the human mind is incredibly complex. And I doubted if we would ever come up with a single concept that would be that unifying and that broad in its application. I have continued to think about that since then, however. And while I won't go that far, there is a central theme that I think is involved in all human relationships, and that I have found in my work with people and with children is more important than anything else, any other concept that I've ever observed. In fact, as I look back on my books, they all involve this central theme, and it's what we were just talking about. It's the word respect. It's how one person evaluates another. It's how one person ascribes worth and dignity to the other person. Dare to Discipline was nothing more than a statement saying, parents, teach your children to respect you. Hide or Seek, my second book, was a manuscript saying, parents, respect your children. What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women, my third book, was a book saying, husbands, respect your wives. Straight Talk to Men and Their Wives was a book saying, husbands, be worthy of the respect of your family. Preparing for Adolescence was a book saying, teenagers, respect yourselves and respect one another. The Strong-Willed Child was another book on the importance of teaching children to respect their parents. Love Must Be Tough. The whole theme of Love Must Be Tough is respect between a husband and wife, and what happens when that respect flows only one direction and not the other. That is, I believe, the single most important unifying factor, and when it is missing in any encounter between two or more people, you got problems on your hands.
And I think of the poor parent who is out there with a brand new child, and they have to have all this wisdom as to how to handle and how to pass on respect and deal with everybody respectfully, and it's very, very difficult. You've been dealing with this for 25 years since you wrote Dare to Discipline, and now in the new Dare to Discipline that we've touched on.
Mike, I remember an article by Dr. Benjamin Spock, who said that the typical response of parents when he hands that new baby to a mother in the hospital, the baby's only 3 days of age and the mother's taking the child home. Mm-hmm. The mother often says, I don't know what to do this child. You know, sure. 100 years ago, mothers and sisters and aunts and grandmothers came in to help that new mother discipline and train and feed and guide. Now the mother is pretty much left on her own, and it is scary.
Well, we have just scratched the surface, obviously, of this very important topic. We are going to come back to it on the next broadcast, and then I think we'll give a couple of weeks to some other subjects and return to the fundamentals of child discipline. We've had so many letters from listeners. They are anxious to get this information. We mentioned Dare to Discipline and the new Dare to Discipline as an important resource on this subject. Is there another book you would recommend as well?
Well, I think that's the book from my own writings that would be most helpful for parents of young children. For those that have a particularly difficult child, I wrote a book called The Strong-Willed Child that might be helpful to people who are out there. Regardless, Mike, I'd just like to put my arm around those mothers out there that are taking care of children. I tell you, I was in an airport yesterday, and I saw a mother and a father with three kids, and they were so lovingly caring for those children. I got tears in my eyes just sitting there. They didn't know that I was watching them. But in this day and age where so many children are neglected and parents don't seem to care, I got to tell you, we need to express appreciation to those mothers and fathers who are giving their primary effort to that task of raising children. And if Focus on the Family can help them do that, what better use of our time and energies could there be?
Absolutely. And as a parent, I can only say amen. Well, on this particular edition of Focus on the Family, if you joined us just a little bit late, we've been listening to a recorded conversation with Mike and Dr. Dobson dealing with some of the fundamentals of child discipline. We'll hear more from them tomorrow on this same subject. Today's program was provided by Focus on the Family. Today's producer was Kelly Crowther. Engineering and production handled by David Salkeld and Jim Adam. Our executive producer is Bobby Valentine, and our host has been psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. I'm Steve Kelly, in for Mike Trout, inviting you back next time when we'll turn our hearts toward home.